Hi, this is Deb Perlman of the Smitten Kitchen, and you're listening to Food Fridays on the Leonard Lopate Show on WNYC 93.9 FM, AM 820, and WNYC.org.
The image of hunger Americans see most is a foreign one, from developing countries stricken by famine. And since we live in one of the wealthiest countries in the world, we assume that the issues of poverty, malnourishment, and hunger exclude us. Of course, that couldn't be farther from the truth. In a new film called A Place at the Table, director-producer Christy Jacobson, director-producer Laurie Silverbush, and executive-producer Tom Colicchio address this pressing issue as one of the most profound threats to our country's future generations. The film opens today at the Sunshine on East Houston Street, also at the Eleanor Bunin Theater in Lincoln Center. And as I understand it, it's available on demand, and you can download it from iTunes. And all of those things bring Christy Jacobson, Laurie Silverbush, and Tom Colicchio to our show today. Hello.
Hi there. Hey. Thanks for having us.
So let's get right to it. What's food insecurity?
Food insecurity is a term that's used to describe a condition in which someone doesn't know where their next meal is coming from on any given day.
And how many Americans are food insecure?
According to the USDA, over 50 million Americans are currently food insecure.
And where does that rank us among the advanced economy countries?
Basically dead last.
Really?
Yes. Of the 23 IMF most developed nations, we are number 23 in food insecurity.
We hear a lot about food deserts in this country. Do they contribute to food insecurity?
Absolutely. I mean, there are so many people across this country who do not have access to healthy and affordable foods. And we found it again and again in our travels in the making of this film, people who have to ride multiple buses and spend many hours just to get to a grocery store where they can buy healthy foods.
Is this a bigger problem in urban or rural communities?
You know, surprisingly, it's a problem in both.
Because we hear a lot about it in places like the poorer sections of New York. But I gather smaller towns also suffer from it.
Exactly. Small towns all over the country, in an area we filmed in the Mississippi Delta, for example, where, you know, they've got to ride, you know, 50 minutes to get to a grocery store to actually get some fruit.
But why would that be? After all, those towns are often in farm communities.
Well, that's the irony. And a big part of it lies with our subsidy system, and the kinds of foods that we subsidize make processed foods cheap and affordable and easy to truck in wherever. And the foods that are being grown in some of those areas are not getting to the people who would need access to them.
Well, Tom, as a restaurateur who has to buy ingredients from, I'm sure, the best sources, what do you think about the way things are subsidized? Why are the things that are often most unhealthy subsidized while the really good things aren't?
Well, large agribusiness has lobbyists that are going to Washington and gobbling up all those subsidies. And, in making the film, that's one thing that we sort of come to realize, that hunger is a political issue. It's a really a political condition.
What crops receive the highest subsidies from the USDA?
Corn, wheat, soy, rice, and cotton.
And what aren't subsidized?
Fruits and vegetables. And I found it interesting that, you know, we grew up with the food pyramid. Now we have a food plate, and half of that plate has fruits and vegetables on it, yet the USDA does not subsidize those fruits and vegetables to the tune of 50% of the actual $20 billion budget.
Well, these subsidies go back a long time. Are we just stuck in the 40s when they began?
They actually began even earlier than that, during the time of the Great Depression. And back then, it was agriculture that was the industry that was too big to fail. So because of the Dust Bowl, because of the Great Depression, the government stepped in and created programs that were really made a big difference in being able to keep farmers on their farms and keep family farms in business. But as the need for these programs went away, the subsidies didn't. And it seems as if it's very hard to roll back any type of entitlement once it's in place. And this is an example of that. So at this point, the best and best funded agribusinesses are collecting, maybe 10% of them are collecting 70% of the government subsidy money.
And that's why when you drive through a lot of farm areas, you just see rows and rows of corn for miles and miles. I like corn, but It seems to me because we subsidize it, people have been forced to find all sorts of other uses for the corn, gas and sugars and all of that.
Very little of that corn that you see is actually the corn on the cob that we actually eat.
Right. 1% of actually corn production is the corn that you like.
So the rest of it is being used for all sorts of other things, and we have to find new uses for the corn because we're subsidizing it?
Yeah, basically. I mean, I don't disagree with that at all. I think what happens is the economic model for growers is just, it's so profitable. If you're going to get paid by the acre to grow something, you're going to choose to grow that. And then on the consumer end, you're going to find ways that you can then turn around and use that product. And one thing that we've seen the food industry do is invest in a lot of science and a lot of, production to create food-like substances to use all of this corn, and it ends up translating into very, very low-cost, very not nutritious food.
In last Sunday's Times, there was a magazine article about how fast food producers find ways to they start off with thinking, okay, we have sugar, we have salt,
fat,
we have fat, we have the corn. Okay, what product can we make?
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Tom, on your TV show, Top Chef, you challenge competing chefs to prepare meals for school kids based on the public school meal budget. How important is our school lunches? Are most of them nutritious around the country?
No, a lot of them aren't. A lot of them rely on commodity products that they're bringing into school. It's very important. When of the 50 million Americans that are food insecure, that includes 17 million children. So if a majority of those children are school age, we can really affect their health by what we're feeding them in school. And yet we're not choosing to look at school lunches as a nutrition program. It's still being treated as a handout program or a welfare program. And so I think that it's really key to making sure that we get really key to sort of the development of a child and make sure that we get healthy, nutritious food into them.
Well, a lot of schools actually serve fast foods, don't they? They wind up relying on the big food chains.
They do. A lot of schools now are set up to actually look like fast food restaurants to serve the same type of products in fast food restaurants. But that has to change. I mean, as an adult, I don't want my kids eating like that. And so I think more adults need to get involved and actually demand that we have better foods in schools.
Well, I was just in L.A. and I went to the California Science Center, which is aimed at educating kids about science. And they have two cafeterias. One is a McDonald's and the other one is a Pizza Hut.
Yeah.
Not a Pizza Hut, a pizza pie alongside a Taco Bell.
Yeah.
And they don't have any – I mean, that's all the food that they offer in a place that – that kids are going to lunch at.
Yeah, it's unfortunate. You mentioned something. Education and food education, I think, is so important. In the film, we have a teacher in Mississippi, Miss Cherry, who is diagnosed with diabetes and decides to use it as a learning experience and a teaching experience in her classroom. And she decides that she doesn't want to be medicated and wants to fight diabetes through proper diet. And so she starts introducing fresh fruits and vegetables as a tool to teach her children in her classroom how to eat better. So I think you're right. I think education on what sort of healthy foods are, how they're grown, I think is very, very important. But then more important is the affordability of healthy foods, and that, again, goes back into the Farm Bill and about what we subsidize.
Well, what kind of response did you get from viewers when you revealed the budget per meal?
In the movie or?
No, I'm talking about the TV show. We'll get to the
people. Yeah, people were shocked. I wasn't sure where you were going with that. People were shocked, and the contestants were clearly stymied because they had very little money to spend on product. It's very easy to cook when you have plenty of and ample good ingredients. It's very difficult when you're hamstrung, and we did that purposely to illustrate how hamstrung the various school districts are when it comes to feeding children.
Chrissy, in the film, you focus on two children, Rosie from Colorado and Tramonica from Mississippi. What types of conditions do both live in?
Well, both of them live in homes and in families where they're not getting enough nutritious food to be productive, and certainly in the case of Rosie, to focus in school. And, she is one of 17 million kids who show up in school wanting to learn, yet you know, feel really distracted and unable to really focus.
Well, doesn't her family receive government assistance?
No. Rosie lives in a house in which she had four working parents, and together they made too much to qualify for food stamps, but not enough to put food on the table for the family, which is a situation that we saw again and again across the country.
Are they helped out by other people in their community?
They are. Rosie's family was fortunate in that a pastor in her community and a school teacher are working incredibly hard to meet the needs of the members of their community, which is a huge percentage of the community. And so she and her family are forced to rely on the handouts that kind people in her community are bringing to her.
Lori, the other child in the film, Tramonica, was considered overweight for her age. Mm-hmm. What other health issues did she have?
Well, she had, in her case, she describes that she has trouble catching her breath in the schoolyard when she plays. So she's suffering from asthma. She is, although she has not herself been diagnosed, the vast majority of kids who are obese are well on the way. They're showing pre-diabetes and pre-heart disease. So you think about this, when an 8-year-old or a 9-year-old is coming to school and getting a routine checkup and they're showing the signs of early heart disease and preventable diabetes.
Well, does she go hungry? She's
She doesn't go hungry, I think, as most people are conditioned to think about hunger. She is not that kid who's got the growling tummy and going to bed at night hungry, although that definitely exists in this country too. She has a mom who's working really hard and is able to put food on the table by being really, really thrifty and making sure that her dollars stretch and she gets what's on sale. And that is chips, that is cookies, that is processed food, that is the, you know, the special 10 boxes of mac and cheese for a dollar or the ramen noodles. So while I would argue that Tramonica may not experience hunger as we often think of it, she's absolutely malnourished. And many, many children in this country, many millions of children, have a third world diet in a first world nation because these foods are artificially cheap because of the factors we mentioned before.
How many areas did you film in?
Well, we filmed in three separate areas. We filmed in Philadelphia, in the small town of Colburn, Colorado, and in the town of Jonestown in the Mississippi Delta. But we also traveled all over the country and filmed, but it's not necessarily in the film, in the making of the
film. Well, in Philadelphia, Barbie Izquierdo, the 20-year-old mother of two, describes being denied food stamps because even though she's only making $9 an hour, which is less than the president is proposing for a minimum wage now.
This is a problem. I think one of the biggest problems with our federal food safety net is that the food stamp program is not meeting the needs of the people who need it. And you know, the food stamps themselves, the means by which one has to qualify, is clearly not working.
What did the people who did receive government assistance tell you about its impact on them psychologically?
Well, it can leave a lifelong scar of feeling inferior, of feeling a sense of shame. Leslie Nichols, a teacher who we spent time with in the film, just talks about how today, you know, as an adult, she often, you know, has those same feelings of inferiority.
My guests are Christy Jacobson, director-producer of A Place at the Table, Lori Silverbush, who is also a director-producer of this film, and executive producer Tom Colicchio. The film A Place at the Table, which opens today in theaters here in New York, also available on demand on through cable. Lori, what was the inspiration for this film? Did it grow out of the fact that you're married to Tom and you think about food?
I think that was definitely part of it. I mean, there was some frustration in watching Tom raising money with other chefs and food professionals for years, decades. They've been raising money for food charities, and they've never raised more than at this moment in time, and we've never had more hunger than at this moment in time. So obviously something isn't working. There was frustration with that. There was also, I had an experience with a young girl who was going hungry. She was somebody I was mentoring, and I got a call from her principal one day that she was foraging in the trash for food. She had gotten into a special program for kids with learning challenges, and that was not a public school, which she had been in previous. That had been her only meal of the day. So I saw how it was impacting her everywhere in her life, and she was starting to get labeled as disciplinary problem, and all kinds of bad things were happening to her. And truly, it boiled down to the fact that she was hungry.
Tom, in New York, a lot of chefs donate money, donate food to the hungry. They also engage in all sorts of charitable events. Is it better for a hungry person to live in a city like New York?
That's a good question. I don't know if it's better because there are.
Well, if you're in a small town.
Well, no, there are food banks. There are food banks across the country, and the food banks here in New York, we have New York Food Bank, and we have City Harvest. Many churches and community organizations are dishing out food, and so there, it's there. But again, this doesn't take care of the root cause of why people are hungry. You know, these charitable programs were set up as an emergency response to hunger, not as the place where people routinely go and get their food. And so, Lori mentioned before, you know, we chefs in New York and across the country have done just an amazing job raising money for some really important organizations, but we're not addressing the root cause of hunger, and that's what we had to explore here, and that's kind of where we really need to go with this.
Isn't there a Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act?
Yeah, there
it's
is
a wonderful name.
Well, we're giggling. It's an ironic title for that bill.
There is a healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act, and I wish that it were indeed that. It's the name that was given to a piece of legislation passed by Congress last year that ultimately, and we show in the film, the comical machinations as that number of what nutritionists actually believe would really make a difference in kids' lives if we funded school lunch and school breakfast programs. We watch as it gets whittled down so that ultimately it ends up being 6 pennies per meal of an increase in terms of the food that kids are actually getting. And that was called, ironically, the Healthy Hunger-Free Kids Act.
So things haven't improved all that much since the Reagan administration, where they tried to label ketchup as a vegetable?
No, I don't think they have.
I would argue they've gotten worse.
Yeah, I mean, I think that there is no priority placed on what kids are eating in schools, and in particular, that bill is a great example of that.
Now, Chrissy, how did you get involved in this? I understand Tom and Lori, they're in the food world, but you've worked on other kinds of documentaries, documentaries on women, HIV and AIDS, what else, base jumping?
Well, I am most drawn to, you know, the stories of real people and stories where there's, in this case, certainly an injustice, and where the power of film can hopefully make a difference. And I was fortunate in that Lori came to me when she started thinking about this idea. Lori's a narrative filmmaker, and the idea of partnering with someone with a narrative filmmaking background was certainly exciting. But more important,
and it was easy just sharing the directing, producing chores.
I would say, yeah. I mean, we both brought to it our own experiences. Mine, I was lucky enough to work with Barbara Koppel, an amazing filmmaker, and learned a lot working with her. But, you know, ultimately it was these shocking, not just the statistics, but the very real struggle that 50 million people are experiencing here that hooked me as much as working with Lori.
Well, how effective do you think a documentary can be? We've seen some pretty great documentaries over the years about this sort of thing and climate change and the like, and yet the politicians don't seem to be moved.
Well, back in 1968, there was a news doc CBS News did called Hungry in America, and very soon after it aired, Americans were outraged. And soon after that, Senators Dole and McGovern got together and created the Modern Safety Net with Nixon in the White House. He signed it. And so a film pretty much and after that law was bill passed, pretty much hunger was wiped out in this country.
For a time,
until the 80s. Mm-hmm. So a film did it once before, and I think it gave Lori and Christy the confidence that a film could do it again.
Well, when people see this film, are they surprised by how serious a problem this has become in this country?
They are. And I mean, I believe that the power of this film is to first and foremost, you know, help people to become aware of a problem that is largely invisible. And so people have responded enthusiastically and certainly shocked at what they learn, but also moved to be a part of the solution.
So where would you start if you suddenly were made food czar? Would you start with farm policy? Would you start with school lunch programs?
I would start with getting across to people that the idea of citizen activism can actually work. I think that we are so conditioned to believe, with politics being so broken, that we can't possibly fix a problem by weighing in. But the name of this movie is very telling. It's a place at the table. And it's not just for the people who need a place at the table, who need food. It's for you, it's for me, it's for everybody. If we engage on this, and I think this film will give people really, really smart ways to do that. And there's, a social action campaign that's going to accompany this film. I think we're going to see a lot of movement on this, and they're telling us that on the Hill. We have legislators
in a time of sequestration?
Absolutely. We're having legislators tell us, because we've been working in D.C. We filmed in D.C., so we have a lot of inroads there, and they tell us, look, if people are calling us on this, if people start to tweet us or text us or email us, we'll start to do these things. We'll vote. We are at a moment of sequestration. We are at a moment where people think in terms of austerity. But the truth is that if you're worried about our budget, then you really want to see this problem fixed, because we are spending many, many multiples of what it would cost to fix this problem on the cost of not fixing it. It's really detrimental to our economy as a whole.
Tom, as a chef of high-end restaurants, although you now have sandwich shops as well, were you aware of this over the years?
Well, yes, I've been aware of it because, again, the last 25 years working with organizations like Share Our Strength, we were very aware of the problem. But again, we were conditioned to believe that raising money was enough, and sort of the charitable response was enough. And in making the film, I've come to realize that this is, again, hunger is a political condition. And I think you asked whether or not you think it can make a difference. Just today, Representative McGovern from Massachusetts was talking about this film on the floor, and urged the president to watch the film, urged Congress to watch the film, and made some really strong comments about the condition that we are allowing, that our leaders are allowing to ferment in our country. And it's already getting recognized.
How many food banks are there now compared to 20 years ago?
It's kind of shocking. I think in 1980 there were 400 food banks in the country, and now we have over 40,000 food banks, pantries, soup kitchens, etc. So obviously, if charity were the answer, we'd have wiped out hunger by now.
But it means that people are responding. On the other hand, it also means that there are more people in need.
I think people are responding in the way that they've been led to believe we'll fix it. Donate money, donate cans of food. That is the message we always get. But ultimately, this is a public health crisis, and it can't be solved through a few very well-meaning, dedicated individuals. It's simply too big. So it requires a governmental response. It requires that as a nation, we fix it.
Well, I've often wondered why we subsidize certain things and not others. When people complain that really healthy foods tend to be more expensive, organic foods, for example, I've always wondered why we don't subsidize organic farming instead of the kind of farming that we do with rows and rows of soybeans and corn.
Well, because it seems so logical, it's a good question to ask. But, the bottom line is, as Tom mentioned earlier, there are these huge agribusinesses with big lobbies that want to keep that going. But I think and hope that the film will help people realize that the onus is on us to make this matter. And if we do that, we should see some change, because we're talking about reallocating funds, not adding more funds into that farm bill.
And this film that we're talking about, A Place at the Table, opens today at the Sunshine Cinema on East Houston Street, also at the Eleanor Bunin Cinema at Lincoln Center. It's available on demand as well. My great thanks to its two director producers, Christy Jacobson and Laurie Silverbush, and executive producer Tom Colicchio, for joining us today on our show.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks so much.